This is Community in Unity, Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue Series. I'm Ann Hillman. This program was recorded on November 17, 2016, with a live studio audience of about 55 people and was open to everyone. The topic, race and identity. We began the conversation with a set of agreements. Enter the discussion with respect, speak your own truths, and be willing to experience the discomfort that comes with openly talking about race. And then the conversation began.
We're talking about race and identity today because it's something that impacts the entire community. We're a community filled with people from around the world, from around the country, and in order to be a strong community, we have to understand each other. So we planned this dialogue long ago, and I'm very pleased that you could all be here to join us. I am not the only facilitator in the room tonight. I chose two other people who are really used to leading conversations about race. So we have April Stahl,
hi,
who is with the Knowing Who You Are program, and Valerie Clark,
hi,
who is with YWCA in the Cultural Connections program. And why I chose these individuals? Because you might be saying, well, awesome, you got three white ladies leading this conversation, is because of the different academic disciplines and the different methods of talking about race. So I chose not based on identity, but based on skill set. And we can feel free to talk about that. We can have that be part of this conversation. What does it mean to be a white person like me leading a conversation about race? Is that an important person to have in this role? Is that not? I mean, these are all things on the table. We're also putting forth a couple definitions. And the first definition we're going to talk about is the definition of racism. And if you are looking for a way to start conversations in your office place, write the definition of racism really big and leave it in the hallway. And you will talk about race all day, trust me. It was an accidental experiment, but it's worth doing. April, please help us.
One of the interesting things about definitions, I'll tell you, every single workshop that I've ever done, I put up a definition, and the next day, two or three people come back and they research their own definition. So in terms of being able to have these conversations, at least for this time, we're hoping that we can at least just agree on these definitions, so it gives us, it at least gives us a framework to have a dialogue, because that's usually where a lot of misunderstanding comes from, is that we're speaking from different terms. So for this purpose, racism is a system of privileges and gives power to one group over another based on skin color. It allows a group of people to be treated as subhuman in order to increase the power of the majority. In the United States, it privileges white people. It's the belief that some races are inherently superior to others. I think it's also really important to make the distinction between racism and discrimination. They're not the same. Discrimination for purposes of this discussion is making distinctions based on the basis of preference or privilege. Involves any situation where a group or individual is treated differently or unfairly based on something other than individual reason, usually because of their membership in a socially distinct group or category. And these definitions we took from Casey Family Programs that developed the Knowing Who You Are curriculum.
Hi, my name's Katie, and maybe one thing that just doesn't resonate as much with my experience is the use of the word skin color is the only thing that defines race or our socially constructed ideas of racial categories. I think that there are sometimes other things that cause people in groups to assign individuals to different racial categories.
I definitely agree with that. In fact, I had a conversation with a coworker today who he's African American, but in the summer when I'm really tan, I'm darker than he is, and he comments on it every time. And so he also said, skin color, how is that a definition? Should we use that in the definition of racism? Would others agree or disagree? Should that be part of the definition?
I think it's part of, Hi, Ambria. I think it's part of the definition because the definition we utilize has more to do with historically how we have treated people of color and not because we ever really sat down and thought about these concepts. I think they grew and to our reality, and then our reality defined the concepts for us. I'm hoping that today side note, that we get to talk about the use of the term African American.
Let's jump into it now. I mean, the idea here is that we're talking about race and identity. And let's talk now. What does that term mean to you? Is it good? Is it bad? Like, tell me about that, please.
So I was born and raised here. I was born in the 80s. So that's when that term's coming about. And for me, it is a term the census utilizes to understand how many of someone they have. It is a term for schools to get funding, for people to get scholarships. I think it has very little to do with me as a person. I don't know that there is an appropriate word for me as a person in this country, but I have never been to Africa. And the issue that I take is it makes it harder to, A, feel like an American, and also, we have actual African Americans. We have people that have directly come from Africa and become citizens and are now African Americans. So it to me just always feels like a little bit of a sting when people utilize that title. And because of that title, there was never a correct term. I don't even know if the utilizing of a correct term is the phrasing I want. But nothing was ever thought about beyond that title.
What feels good to you, for you?
I'm Black, but I don't know that that is correct. Because again, the conversation never happened at the appropriate time. So there's been no development of an understanding of who we are in this country, ever. Anytime there is, it gets stunted by something really stupid. So then we stop having the conversation and then people are kind of like, what do you mean? Why are you upset? What are you bothered by? Like, you don't even really know who I am.
Do you feel like all of these labels are just coming from the outside and you have...
Yes, absolutely. No one within the community thought of that. It is always... A community of people are named outside of their community. Mm-hmm. That is every community with a special little American at the end.
My name's Tavy, and I'm an author and former teacher, and I wanted to kind of piggyback on what you said about identity and being defined. Because it ties into the beginning of this conversation where you introduced facilitators that were three white women. And that was one of the triggers for me, because I'm listening, I'm trying to be very calm and say, okay, I'm giving everybody a chance, because this is a talk about race and we don't get to, you know, own it and say that, oh, we're the only ones that get to speak on this. But then when you had said your reasons, you mentioned skill set, and that really bothered me, because as a teacher, I know that the predominant culture defines the skill set, and other people bring skills to the table that are not respected in this country. And it's really starting to become painful, because I know what other people and other cultures bring to the table. But as a teacher, I tried to hold kids accountable to these standards, and they couldn't meet them because they weren't for them. And so they failed. And again, I see we're coming to discussion on race, and we open it up, and we've already failed to meet the standard to be on the panel, you know? And it wasn't intended that way, but that's just kind of the hit that it felt to me. I'm like, wow, we've really got to talk about what we value and what we consider a skill set, and who gets to define that in this country. That's all I have to say.
I appreciate that input very much, because you're right. Like, I was looking to different teaching methods that I was familiar with, which means I didn't necessarily look beyond things I had experienced. How can we remedy that? I mean, I'm not looking to you to give every solution. how did it make other people in the room feel? And April, if you would like to jump into this as well, mm-hmm. April, would you like to provide a little bit more about your own identity?
See, that's the thing that I think is really interesting. So when we talk about race and we talk about skin color, when we see each other for the first time, our brains try to categorize each other. It's just a natural thing that happens, right? And I don't know what they are, I wonder, you know? And so we really struggle with having these conversations. And when folks see me, they see a white woman. And I'm Passamaquoddy Indian, Czechoslovakian and Hungarian. So that's not all who I am, right? So we were having this discussion about how sometimes other people view your race, it almost defines how they think your identity should be, right? Ethnicity, culture, none of that is taken into consideration. It's just, boom, this is what I see, and this is how people respond to me. And it can be really confusing, right? Because it's based off of their perception of how they're categorizing you, and it can be completely off mark. So I run into this all the time. Folks are like, you're not Native. You're not Native American. Yeah, I am. Well, you don't look it. I get that all the time. You don't look it, right? And so I just think you guys are all bringing up very good points about institutionalized racism, you know, in the education system, and just how we tend to view each other. So I think we're starting to have this brave dialogue. And we also wanted to throw it out there is that we had a discussion earlier tonight. And when we talk about how the system, really how the social construct of race was created, it was created by white people for our benefit to oppress other people. So when we had the discussion about who should really be talking about this, and we agreed that we don't feel there's going to be a massive shift until more white people stand up and start to have this dialogue and facilitate these discussions and stop shying away from them. Because we also don't want to just keep putting people of color up in front and keep being victimized so that some white folks can feel better about it and not have to have the dialogue. So we were struggling with that a little bit.
My name is Kokai. I have a question rather than a statement or contribution on this front. What is the resistance when it comes down to identity of quote-unquote so-called white people viewing themselves as a tribe rather than a coalition of individuals? Not individuals, but as a tribe, meaning that you interact in America as a tribe and respond to things in a tribal manner, not as individuals. What's the resistance?
My name's Rebecca. I think that what you were saying, the reason a lot of white people don't identify as a tribe, I think, is because how that has been abused. I mean, when I think about the like white nationalist movement right now, that, you know, if I think about identifying with white people as a tribe, I recognize what that's been used for so much. And it seems like it would come with... I think sometimes identifying as white and looking at other white people as a tribe feels dangerous in a country where there already is a system of inequity and that already represents a system of power. It seems like an abuse of power in a way.
My name is Kim, and my husband is Jamaican. And with me being, you know, black and from the South, we have a dialogue, whereas he says that we pretty much separate ourselves. Like if you're Chinese, you say Chinese American. You know, it's always American added, just like African American. Mm-hmm. But for Jamaicans, they do not class like that. It's just Jamaican. So if your background is Japanese, you're still Jamaican. If you're white, you're still Jamaican. So they don't see as far as separating. They see themselves as one, and that's their motto. So I do believe that, yes, we should get away from saying African-American, Caucasian, you know, Mexican. You know, we should just all have on there American, and that's just it.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. A couple of days ago in a third grade class, a young boy was pointing out that what he thought was that I was black and a couple of the other boys there were black and that he was white. And this is a common mistake that everybody makes because black is like the curtains and then white is like the paper. And there's, you know, except for albinos, there aren't any real white people. And there's not any really black people. There's just gradients of brown people. Because very dark brown looks black, and very light brown looks sort of white or beige. So I think there's just this misnomer about people separating themselves by color when it's all the same color, just gradients of dark brown, or gradients of brown, I should say.
Well, then you have Louisiana. In Louisiana, we had several categories of African Americans. We had Creoles, we had mulattoes, octoroons, etc. On my birth certificate, it says I'm Negro. My grandmother was colored. When I went to college, I became black. When I met Stokely Carmichael, I became African American. So these were philosophical and political ideas and thoughts about who I was. And the color had nothing to do with it. The color has remained the same, but I've gone from Negro to African American to et cetera, to ad nauseum.
I think it was a useful sorting mechanism. It was indelible, it was identifiable, and it was useful for the allocation of resources and reward.
Yeah, I appreciate the discussion about race being a social construct, but I know that as a white person, when I hear at least other white people saying, oh, let's not label race, let's not talk about it, let's be colorblind, what they're saying is that they don't want to think about the inequities that fall in racial categories. They don't want to think about the fact that they, as white people, are privileged in this social categorization of race. And so because power and privilege is distributed differently by race, we have to talk about it in order to create the equity so that we really can be, you know, this wonderful sort of united community that we want to be, but we're not, because right now people of color are being attacked in hate crimes at you know, increasing rates, are disproportionately incarcerated, and can't get the same jobs that they're totally qualified for. So that's why I think we have to use the social construct of race.
Hi, I'm Kim again. Well, since the election, race has really played a big part. And with Donald Trump being elected, it just like, I mean, what he stands for is like this really shocking. You know, me and my husband was shocked the next day, like, what? Really? It's crazy, you know? And it says a lot of this country, you know, and the minorities, you know, it was just, it's scary. Because it's like, where do we go from now as a country? Because of what he stands for.
Even if you're pro or against, it's not even the point. Once someone says certain things out loud with their mouth hole, and you're still like, but yeah, but they're gonna do these other things too, you immediately say to me that these other things that he or she might have said with their mouth hole isn't as important, because you're gonna get like these treats after. So then, it doesn't matter. Like, maybe he'll be the best president ever. Who knows? It's insane in my brain, but whatever, it's fine. The point is, you can't just be crazy out of your mouth hole and then be the president. Like, that's not been like the standard, you know? That's been hard. So when people are like, yeah, he's gonna do this, give him a chance, let him president. And I'm like, no, because he said crazy things.
No, it's not just he said crazy things. It's been proven that he's been racist towards black people as far as in his properties.
Kokai again. Within my tribe, which is called by different names, like my elder, Cal Williams, across there, identified coming out of Louisiana, different names that we didn't pick. The name that we did pick, starting off, that I think is pretty universal, is like Moore or original person, trying to get closer to the indigenous. We almost have two different frames that we have the conversation about race about, okay? We have the one which is pretty sanitized that we do with white people. Then we have the one that we don't, where it's not sanitized. And we're starting to have that unsanitized version on social media, not caring about feelings, because the pressure is too great for us to be dealing with white fragility. Mm-hmm. That's a term, that's an academic term. Mm-hmm. I think I'm 4 or 5 years old. The first time I go to Fairview Elementary, I grew up here in Anchorage, Alaska. Before I become clear, I am a black person in America. Mm-hmm. original person, whatever, a Negro, a colored person, African, whatever you want to use the term of, but I become it becomes clear in my mind, I am a black person in America. I get a talk from my parents about how to be a black person in America and navigate white feelings. That's that talk. That's that field talk, not that house Negro talk. Okay? So then the question becomes, since I know I grew up with my parents having their childhood experience being the civil rights movement and hearing the stories of how to interact with a white woman on the street corner without getting lynched, how to interact with the police without getting lynched, how to walk into a classroom and see nobody reflected that looks like me and not get lynched. My question, again, I'm gonna come back with another question. What from the civil rights movement, childhood stories, wrestling, did you hear growing up? This is what it felt like to discriminate against a Negro. This is what it felt like to lynch a Negro. This is what it felt like to be in one of those mobs. Because we're having a conversation almost as if we're walking around like genocide never happened in American soil and that slavery never happened in American soil. And we've got people in Congress who you cannot tell me were not brought to a lynching as a child. And we're walking around acting as if without any therapy, they can represent us in Congress and be post-racial. So there becomes the question of what did you get from the civil rights movement that we're not talking about from the other side, because I know exactly what black people got.
My name's Tim, and I'd like to add on what he said. A lot of the time I hear like my white friends tell me that it happened a long time ago and just let it go and act like it's nothing. And I think it's almost like a child where if you abuse it as a kid and then it grows up, it's still gonna have problems as an adult. You can't just say that happened when you were five, that someone abused you, just grow up and let it go. I think America has a lot of problems from the past. And you know, you build a house on a foundation. If the foundation was kind of bad and the built in the beginning of building the house, it's gonna have problems when you as you put the house on top of it. And I wonder if anybody has anything to add to that.
So. Historical generational trauma is real. Historical grief is real. When we still see people of color disproportionately represented in prison systems and foster care systems, the racism that started created these institutions, and the institutions are benefiting from it. It's oftentimes about money. It's turned a little bit away from power, but when you look at the prison systems and you look at why so many people of color are incarcerated, there's some big companies making a lot of money off of it, off of keeping people incarcerated. And so,
just because owning a person supposedly is illegal doesn't mean that we haven't found brand new ways of enslaving entire groups.
Yes.
And because
we don't want to talk about
it.
We're
really good at that.
And we don't want to go there.
Different ways to work around the system.
And so this is part of the problem, right? We look at, there's kind of this perception of if they're in prison, they must have done something to deserve it, right? They should be there. They should be. It's, you know, you see these kinds of belief systems perpetuated in the media and in movies, you know. So then it's okay. It somehow makes it okay if we have people of color being used as slave labor in the prison systems. It's somehow okay because they deserve it, because that's, they committed a crime and that's how they got there. But when you start to look at in terms of disparity, right, when you talk about how two folks who look completely different commit the same offense, but the person of color is the one institutionalized, I wonder why that is. Why is that?
My name is Kim, and today I was speaking about how I was really glad that I'm not living in the lower 48 due to the racism that's going on with all people of color down there. I feel safe here in Anchorage, Alaska. But there is racism right here in Anchorage. It's really low key, but it is. I would like to also say this. We've had a lot of immigrants come in, Somalians, all folks from Africa, all just from all over the place. I never thought that there was prejudice inside of me. You know, in America, it is deep. It is embedded. Regardless, if you may say, oh, no, I'm not prejudiced, all right? But inside, there is some sort of racism. There is some sort of, well, she's got a big butt, or her lips too big, or she's too black, or, oh, my goodness, look at that. Mine was, who are these Somalian people? Where do these black people come from? You know? And I had a problem with that. Why are there children on my grass? You know? But they're children from my homeland, you know, people I don't even know. But it was so deep, and I didn't realize why I felt that way. You know, I had to go and pray. You know, and that's the whole point here. America, we have turned away from God. I don't know if they're, you know, I do. I believe in God, you know. But America has turned away. Prayer out of the schools or whatever. But there's going to have to be a change. We as a people, as a nation, has to change. I see some dark days. And not just for minorities. I see just for all of us.
Hi, my name is Marge. I just wanted to address the question that was raised about what I learned or heard as a child about the civil rights. And despite the fact that I was born in the mid-60s, I didn't hear anything. I heard silence. I lived in a completely white community, and I heard nothing until I went to a chosen community, went to college in a place with people that didn't all look like me. And then I learned about it. So I heard silence growing up, and then I read about it in history books in high school, despite the fact that it had happened in my lifetime, essentially. So I feel very, very grateful to live in a community in which, my kids are growing up with people from all around the world and all around the country who look like them and don't look like them. And when they were little, they didn't use labels. If they were describing someone to me after their day at school, they would say they were brown. Or they look like you, Mom, but there were no labels. And of course, now they've gained labels as they're teenagers. But at least the labels are a little more specific. You know, they're Islander, or more specific to where people have come from. So I feel grateful to live here and be surrounded by you all and having this conversation.
My name is Hope, and I too want to share with you. Because when I was 6 years old, I went in 1970, I went to a progressive camp, and there was a pool, there was big pools there. And I remember, and I'm shaking right now because, like, I can't see you, but you were talking over there, that it is in our cellular memory. Because when I was 6 years old, I was going into a pool, and there was a black girl that jumped in the pool right next to me. And I remember feeling disgusted. And at the same time, I started crying, because I knew that was a terrible way to feel. And it was the same feeling of when I accidentally threw a shoe to my cousin's eye and hit him in a, gave him a black eye. So at 6 years old, that's in my memory, that I felt that, and that was, it was a terrible way to feel. But I still felt it. Where did that feeling come from? My parents purposely sent me to this camp. All these kids, everybody was, you know, having fun together. Everybody was singing, da da da. But I felt that, and that's what I learned in 1970. It was still that period.
You're listening to Community in Unity, Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue Series. On November 17th, about 55 people gathered to discuss race and identity.
My name is Laura, and I grew up in Anchorage. I was born here in Alaska, and I went to college in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I remember thinking and learning about racism and thinking about, like, well, Alaska's not racist. It's North Carolina that has a racism problem. And then I learned about the lunch counter sit-in movement that started in Greensboro, just on the street from where I was, and started learning intensely about racism and racist systems, and started thinking about the intense racist history that we have as Alaskans when it comes to Alaska Native people. Absolutely. And how we treated Indigenous people here as dogs, and had signs in our stores that said no natives or dogs. And when I came back to Anchorage, it was intense to be among all of these white people who thought we didn't have a problem like the South. Whereas I was having real discussions about race in the South and was getting weird commentary about how, well, Native people are just alcoholics, or Native people are just X or Y or whatever it is, and having that not in that same sphere of this is racist language, this is a racist system, and how Alaskans were so north, we're like way north in the north, and we're like so not racist, but yet we have this intense history that is incredibly recent that is just as racist and obstructionist, and that I think that we see in some incredible ways on our streets and in our community as well.
So my name is Anthony. So just going back to a couple of points that have been made earlier, as a white male, I think part of the reason I like haven't had the discussions about race is because I've sort of operated in the privilege where I can look away on issues such as race. Like, that's not something I had to talk about. And going back to the point as sort of just like, how are these white people responding to the civil rights movement and how they're taught? It's that we're, because we have this privilege, we're allowed to look away from sort of the horrible things done by other members of our own race. Mm-hmm. And when you say, how can these people still lead us? It's because they have the privilege to be able to look away and sort of be like, those events are past, but because I belong to this category, I can sort of continue forward.
Well, and it's certainly a fallacy that these things are in the past, too. I mean, when we talk about, oh, well, lynchings happened in the past or whatnot, you know, we have all sorts of horrible, violent things happening to people on a daily basis. And just because we're not, we don't have large crowds of white people holding picnics at them anymore, doesn't mean that they aren't violent, that they aren't horrific, and that they don't have the same level of violence and oppression as what we've. Well, they don't put it in the history books, do they? Because white people write the history books. But yeah, we don't have to look backwards because we have the privilege of not looking backwards. My mother, all of my people are from Southeast Alabama. That's why I live in Alaska. I love them, but no. They're not Facebook friends either. But my grandfather was a lovely man who was a sheriff in Alabama. And my mother, who grew up in the 50s and 60s, always said she'll watch a show and she'll see something on a march or a lynching. And she'll go, I never saw that kind of stuff. And I went, you were the sheriff's kid. Now, first of all, you know that was happening. He may have been at them. I love granddaddy, but he may have been at them. And of course he kept you away from it. And so it's sort of this willful, and only we, you know, we're the only ones really allowed to be that willful about it and to pretend like it didn't happen.
Yes, I want to add on to about, you know, the young black men are being institutionalized, but like you said, if it's two parties and they had marijuana, you know, they let one go and then give the charge to another.
But if you think about it, that's also, if you get a record, you can't apply for Pell, because when you apply, it tells you you have a drug conviction. So if you're not getting educated, that breaks down to what's your other options? Mm-hmm. Either to go back on the streets, and it's a continuous cycle. Mm-hmm. Also, it also breaks down the family home, because now you do not have that strong black male that's in the home. And that, and deeply in the South, is that Jim Crow that's still going on to this day. And so now you're making the black woman who always had to carry the burden to carry the household in this modern time. And now she's having to educate herself to, you know, to get on the playing field to actually get a wage. And so now she's black, that's a strike against her. She's a woman, that's a strike against her. And she doesn't have her partner. So, you know, as a black community, it breaks down even further. And then with the Jim Crow in the South, like me growing up, I'm light-skinned, you know? I'm light-skinned. I was teased and saying, oh, your father is white. And I would cry. No, my father is black. And so they actually broke us down, even in slavery, that when you was light-skinned, you was in the home. If you was dark-skinned, you was in the fields. Mm-hmm. And black folks still carry on to this day. We have something against, if they see a light-skinned person, oh, they think they better than, you know, me. You know, and it's still happening to this day. And so we have to come together as a unity within even the black community of saying we need to throw out all racial, even with our own color, of how dark you are, mm-hmm. or how light you are. You know, so it really starts at home.
I had kind of a positive influence from my father. He told me that the juke joints that he attended when he was a kid were really the best fun that he had when he was a youth. And that was kind of striking, because later on he became a state party chairman of a Democratic Party in Washington State, and we went through the whole Bobby Kennedy thing, the Martin Luther King thing, Johnson was president, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, all that stuff he was involved with and engaged with, and I kind of participated as a kid. So it was actually kind of a positive experience. Later on, I hitchhiked, after he died, to Alaska, and I was asleep on the sidewalk in Fairbanks with about 30 other Native kids, or people, men mostly, and we were waiting to go out on fire control, and the guy came up and he said, you want to go to work? And he hired me, and then I turned and I looked, and he hired two people out of that experience, and both of us were white. And I turned to the Native gentleman that was next to me, laying on the sidewalk, and he says, go ahead, make the money, you'll need it. And I thought that was kind of gracious of him, really. But it illustrated for me personally how important that privilege is. And it isn't surrendered. It isn't going to be surrendered. It's going to have to be acquired. And I think that the positive upside to how that will happen is demographics, because the demographics are going to control this process, and they're irreversible, and it's going to prevail in the, like, the coming decades. So just kind of keep that as the back of your mind, that it's going to happen. But it's not going to be easy. There's going to be lots of things that'll be difficult. But it's going to happen. So kind of prepare for the best.
My name is Emily. And I just wanted to go back to the comment that you said, Laura. And I think one thing that is glazed over pretty frequently is that in Anchorage in particular, I do think it's quite segregated, and I work for an organization that is focused in Mountain View, and you hear all the time it's celebrated that Mountain View is the most diverse neighborhood in the United States and how great that is. And I have trouble with that, because on one hand you want this historically disinvested neighborhood to have a positive identity, and a lot of really great things have come from it, but it's also known for a lot of other most, which is most unemployed, most impoverished, most uneducated. And so it's not separate from these social constructs, even in Anchorage. So I think that's an important thing to be thinking about as well.
My name is Valerie. And I kind of wanted to touch on something that the young lady over there was stating. We do have our own internal racisms. And a lot of that, if anybody's familiar with the letter of Willie Lynch, We're talking about a good 400 or 500 years of embedded reconditioning. And so when you recondition a mind that, you know, certain skin colors, you know, have certain privileges, even with own internally, then you have that bias and stereotype attitude toward even one another. Also, light-skinned people, a lot of times, don't have to have a white dad or grandma, but most Afro-Americans in the United States have a mixture of bloodline, whether it be Indian bloodline or Caucasian bloodline. And that's also from 400 years back and three of some of the incest that was going on within plantations, okay? So, I mean, there's a lot of history that once you start understanding history, you kind of understand where you go, where you came from, and where you're going. Now, what bothers me now is the Make America Great Again. I don't know if anybody else is taking that in internally, but myself, being Afro-American, I probably have a little different perspective of that Make America Great than the average Caucasian, because I don't even know what that is. You know, I know my history, and Make America Great, even though I love being American, you know, I would not take that. But if I look at my past, I don't know anything that my mom, my aunt, my grandmother, or anything told me that was so great. Okay, so we have a lot of soul searching to do internally, me, myself, and you know, if you're not soul searching about how you feel about certain things, then you're not doing yourself any just for even being here, because we grew up understanding, knowing things that we were told as a child. If it's not something that you've seen, heard, or been taught, you know, from your parents or an elder or someone else about differences, and accepting differences, be it a color of a skin, color of your hair. You know, I know blonde hairs have more fun or whatever that is. I mean, that was something that people were taught, and that was something people heard, you know. So it's a lot of internal things. But we just have to kind of get, I think, beyond where we're at now and try to move forward. And I really appreciate this group of people and the candidness and the openness that they're having. So,
all right, I want to bring up stereotyping and putting people in labels and boxes. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Diamond and South, and a lot of people there was a lot of white people and a lot of Asians. And it's funny, growing up, being told you're not black enough by people that aren't black is quite strange. You got the Asian people using the N-word, listening to the rap. You know, you got the, I didn't smoke weed in high school or anything, so people are telling me, oh, you're black, you're supposed to smoke weed. Or I read books for fun, you know, I'm one of those people, and they're like, you read books, but you're black. And, you know, I had this in high school. And then at the same time, I'm up here pursuing this girl, you know, she's a blonde, white girl. Her dad knows nothing about me, and she tells him about me, and he tells her that she can't see me anymore because I'm a 18-year-old black guy that might drug and rape her. So I'm getting mixed signals from these people. These are a bunch of white, Asian, there's just a couple black people, but either like you're too black on one hand, you can't date my daughter, but you're not black enough that you're not fitting our stereotype. And I'm before, like, I'm just trying to be me and do myself. And it's you know, it's a very uncomfortable thing. And then it's funny, black people, I think we do it to ourselves too. Cause you know, when someone steps out of not being what we consider black, like, you know, you got a black friend and he has a country music on his iPod, you're what are you doing? What is that, you know? And as black people, I think we police ourselves, but I feel like the bigger culture does it too. Like, you try to make each other fit in the label instead of letting ourselves express ourselves. Or I feel like white people, they can throw on a cowboy hat, they can put a baseball cap on backwards, they can wear tight jeans, baggy jeans, they can get away with it. But when you're black, you put on cowboy boots and all of a sudden you're like an alien.
So I grew up in New Hampshire, and my family was the black family in the school district of five towns. Now, realizing that it was the University of New Hampshire. So when I was a little kid, there's maybe 5,000 students, maybe seven. But the towns around that were tiny. They were 200-300 people, dairy country. You stick out. And my mom was white. Now I can tell you, there were people who did not like that. And when I finally went away to college, to a place that was much more diverse, just outside of Boston, I had black people trying to tell me how to be black, because obviously I didn't know. Can I just tell you, I'm me? And that's something that I have to say this. Maybe you don't know, if you're not a quote-unquote minority, that it's a privilege to just be yourself. It's okay if you want to have 9 piercings up one ear. I mean, yeah, okay, your mom or dad might give you grief. But there's not this idea of, if you're white, you must have this, you must be that. Or conversely, if you're black, you're a bad person, or you're never going to be beautiful because you're not Farrah Fawcett and you don't have blonde hair and your butt's too big. Really? And if you're black, oh, well, for me it was, well, you're not black enough. What is this thing on your head? It's all bushy. It's not kinky hair. It's not straight hair. I'm like, it's my hair. Come on, people. Your lips are too thin. All of that. And I look at so many of my friends and I think that intersection of what it is to be a woman, and I get any woman looking at a fashion magazine would probably end up in tears, but if you're black, mm-hmm. you're not there. And I can remember my mom was so excited when Oprah magazine came out, she got it for me because she's like, there will be all kinds of women in there. And I was like, she still gets it for me. And I'm like, Mom, don't bother. they've gone white. And white is beautiful. But if it's supposed to be for black women, again, where are we? Where is it okay to be me? I don't need you to think that I'm gorgeous. But I don't need just existing to be a political statement.
I'm Cal, and I guess I'm the senior here. I'm going to admit, 75 years old. When I was 14 years old, about 70 miles from me, another 14-year-old was killed. At the time, I was in love with Marilyn Monroe. This 14-year-old was killed for supposedly whistling at a white lady 70 miles from my house, Emmett Till. We were both 14 at the time. So we talk about the memory that's ingrained in you. I've been involved in the civil rights movement since 1963 with CORE. This that we're talking about is not an event, it's a process, and we need to keep this dialogue going. A couple of years ago, I spoke over at the university, and a young lady, black, probably a sophomore, stood up and said, I'm glad we don't have racism anymore. So we have work to do, and I appreciate what's happening here tonight. God bless all of you.
Can I also say, too, that one of the things that I always ask people when we have a training, there are people that should be in on this conversation who are still exempting themselves from it. And so one of the things that we can do, I mean, I've heard a lot of white women wailing on Facebook since last Tuesday about what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I'm going to put on a pantsuit. And I was like, yeah, you could do that. Or you can wear a pantsuit and go out and actually do something. So if you're working in a place where it's all white people, then talk to your boss if he's a white dude and talk to him about diversifying a little bit and hiring some people that don't all look like a saltine box. You know, so this is a room full of people who care about it and cared enough about it to come out and talk and to have a discussion about it that's, I mean, been very productive and peaceful, and it's great. And the people who can make some changes and who are in power to make those changes are the people who never come to these. So we have to go back out there into the community and talk to those people.
My yes. name is Victoria, and I came here because my class was reading about subsistence. I'm Inupa. People don't always realize that, especially when they see my eyes. They're not brown. My experience living here is really, really different in that I encounter racism in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's just the shock that I'm actually intelligent. That happened my senior year when service was actually the equivalent of South, and I came into town to live with my parents. And people were really angry. They were very, very angry that this Native kid was incredibly smart and didn't give a what they thought. And the other thing is, I went to law school not because I wanted to, but my grandmother, she asked me to go, and I said, no, you have two granddaughters already who are lawyers. And she said, but I raised you. And I said, why? And she said, I was born free, but I'm not going to die free. I want to know why. What happened to us? How did we lose everything? We fought no war. We killed no one. And what do you say to that? I went to law school. I absolutely hated it. And I was sent to the dean because I was like, your law has no honor. My first language was not English, it was Coramio. The way I thought is circular or spiral, depending. My experiences with white people have been fascinating. My father's family was lovely to me. But white people, I can only handle so many as friends at a time because you get tired of explaining. You really do. It's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And I'm really not interested in teaching outside of my job. But I'm glad you're having this conversation. But what you fail to realize is we never asked to be American. We never volunteered our land. And ANCSA wasn't a settlement, it was imposed. It's a unilateral act of Congress. So we could have been some of the richest people on this planet with that oil. But now we're at street corners. Our societies were deliberately deconstructed. They knew that corporations would fail. Mm-hmm. They'd already done it to the Menominee and the Klamath tribes. They knew we were unprepared to run them. They knew once taxes on the land were enforced, we'd lose it all. The corporations are only profitable because changes were made in the law. That's our truth. Are we very welcome here? No. No. My father literally asked my brother and I at a Thanksgiving dinner why we both chose to be Inupiaq when we could pass, and our lives would be so much easier. Do you know how painful that is to hear your father say that to you? My brother kicked me under the table, and I told my father we found a world that was so beautiful, we couldn't be anything else. Because we come from people who believe in honor. We come from people who spoke the truth. We come from people who dreamed, and they didn't need to diminish someone else's soul to be human. Dara.
You bring up, I think, a really good point about Native Americans in this country and Alaska Natives. And a lot of the stuff that we don't want to talk about. And in fact, I was just having a discussion earlier today. A training I did all day on Monday was teaching foster parents about the importance of culture and talking about the history of Alaska and talking about the BIA and the boarding schools and what happened. And so why some folks might not understand how someone could say, you know, why would you be when you could pass? It became survival at one point for folks who could pass to do so, because Native people across the country were rounded up and put in boarding schools. And then the other thing that we don't talk about either, you guys, some of you might know, but when we talk about World War II and we talk about the Japanese internment, the Aleut people were interned, Yunungan people were interned. And slave labor for the government. They had to harvest seals so that our government could make money. And then as soon as they realized, ooh, we lost so much money, they made them come back. Soldiers during World War II and the men that were interned, they said, you have to come back and do the seal slaughter. And if you don't, you can't go back to the island. We're not gonna bring you back. So when you talk about these layers of trauma and layers of grief and how we talk about, if you ever watch the Aleut story, my friend Tara Bordakovsky's grandmother and mother is in that video. And one of the other ladies said, but the kid said, why isn't it in the history books? Did it really happen? If it really happened, wouldn't we learn about it? And so I think that's why these conversations are so important, because it's not documented in a lot of places. And I'm just super grateful for all of you guys being willing to share and being able to say what's in your hearts and what your experience has been. It makes a big difference.
One of the things we really didn't talk about at all is the discrimination factor. And I mean that for people transgendered and different sexual orientations, because that is just as frightening and just as scary in this time and what is happening to this group of people. And I don't want us to leave here today without acknowledging that.
Thank you all very, very much for being here today and for opening yourselves and for sharing your stories and being willing to listen to other people's stories, being willing to give constructive criticism, being willing to start the conversation. This is just the beginning. This is all we have time for this evening. But there will be more.
That was Community and Unity, Race and Identity. It's part of Alaska Public Media's Community Dialogue series. The show was recorded on November 17, 2016, at the Alaska Public Media Studios in Anchorage. Our audio engineer was Dave Waldron. I'm the producer and host, Ann Hillman. You can find other episodes of Community and Unity on our website, alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening.